We'll call the meeting to order. This is a State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, February 15th, 2012. We have a quorum. Would someone move the minutes from our meeting of the 14th of February? Super. Representative Banyan moves those minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved.
Mr. Chair? Sorry that I didn't jump in there in time, but I don't see my name on there as members present.
Okay, well, let us let us move to amend the minutes of the 14th to include Representative Moline's name. All in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. You were here. Thank you. Thanks for catching that. The next item on the agenda is to consider House File 2033. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 2033 be passed and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. You may proceed and understand you have author's amendments as well.
Mr. Chair, yes, if I could, just to move those before we actually have the full discussion on the bill. I'd like to move the A3 amendment. And if you'd like, I could give a brief description of it, or we can just move it, and then I can describe the whole bill at your choice.
Why don't you give a brief description, and then we'll vote on it to get the bill in the shape the author prefers.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the A3 amendment actually attempts to take the input from the Government Operations Committee discussion that we had and amend a couple of things. There was some discussion about whether we could do this study internally, and I had explored that. It does not seem that that's a viable possibility, and so it specifically says that we do this with an outside firm. And then there was some discussion about whether or not education and experience levels should be part of the comparison, and I thought that was a good point. And so there's a line in there indicating that the factors that would be considered in the job descriptions would also include the educational and experience levels necessary to perform the job. And then there was a comment made about whether or not this would be done on a regional basis, and I think it's fair to say that any professional firm doing this would give us a regional comparison, but I added that in there to make sure that was clear as well, that we wouldn't be comparing totally different regions of the country in these job comparisons. So that's the A3 amendment.
Any question about the amendment? If not, all in favor of the author's requesting that the bill be amended to his reference here. All in favor of that amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Next amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The A4 is an amendment that I chose to add here just recently. We've had a lot of discussion about this bill's potential impact on collective bargaining, and it has never been my intent to actually do anything that would somehow supersede collective bargaining. The original intent of the bill was that we would take advantage of the Commissioner of Management and Budget's ability to redesign job classifications and things, quote-unquote, on the fly in between collective bargaining and contracting cycles. I think as compared to actually pursuing that angle in as it's currently in the bill, I'd prefer just to take the potential issue with collective bargaining off the table to truly have this be a study. And so the study would be conducted as an input to the next round of collective bargaining, and it would be published to the chairs of the respective committees in the legislature, and would therefore be a public piece of information. And that would then hopefully over time influence what happens in collective bargaining and influence the job classifications in the state complex, and perhaps the legislature would choose to act on it in a more concrete manner at that point. But this amendment basically says, let's do the study and have that as input into the next round of collective bargaining, and the legislature can do with it what it will at that point. But let's not actually have the current provision in the bill, which would force the actual implementation of the new kind of balanced equal pay scales into the public sector complex here before the next round of collective bargaining.
Question about the amendment, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, who will do the study, and how many? Will it be a scientific study, or will it be just...
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, the A3 amendment says that it would be done by an outside firm, and I believe management and budget, as I did a quick scan of their fiscal note, I just saw it this morning, it appears that they've given quite a bit of thought to the RFP process and how they would go out and retain an outside firm. So that might be a question we can hold and ask them, at least their current thinking on exactly how they do that when they come down. I see they're on the list to testify.
Okay. But we...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, we're going to have the amendment on the bill before that, right?
Representative Murphy, what we're doing here is getting the bill in the shape the author prefers, and as a courtesy to the author, I think we ought to, when we debate the bill, we ought to have it as the author prefers.
Okay. Part of trust.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, before this goes on, I heard you just describing the A3 and A4 amendment as sort of getting out of the way of the collective bargaining process, but I just want to make sure there's nothing in here in these either of these amendments that you're proposing that touches subdivision 3 of the bill on line 2.3. Is there? That's the one that says that this bill supersedes PELRA. Oh, you okay, Mr. Shepard? Just okay. I see. You are deleting page 2 all the way to line 9. Okay, I see. I get it now. Thanks.
Yep.
There are no further questions on the A4 amendment. Representative Downey has moved that amendment. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Representative Downey, the bill is now in the form you prefer.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Actually, you have heard this bill, at least in its previous version, in committee last year. We actually passed it as part of House File 192, so I don't think this is terribly new. But the purpose of it is to part the clouds and hopefully answer once and for all, or maybe not once and for all, but at least once, this overriding question that we seem to always come back with, and that is, are we fairly compensating our employees here in state government? And I think some of the testimony that you'll hear from the study that was done by the Taxpayers Association and from other folks that want to come in and give their opinion on the bill will probably provide a nice round kind of overview of the bill and the pros and cons of it. I just want to come back to the overriding intent here, and that is to make sure that we as legislators, that we as citizens of the state of Minnesota, and we as workers in state government are all comfortable that we are fairly compensating, both from a wages and benefits standpoint, our public sector employees, and that we've got that compensation structured in a way that allows them the tools and the flexibility and empowers them to join with us on this very tough journey that we have of starting to restructure and rethink the way we do things in state government. So this study's intent is to part the clouds and show where, in fact, we are undercompensating our state employees compared to the private sector, where we are fairly compensating them, and where we are overcompensating them, and then provide that as information to the legislature and the executive branch and the collective bargaining process as we go forward to hopefully over time start to right the ship on all of those fronts. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd stand for any immediate questions on the bill or further discussion on the amendments, and then I know there's quite a few folks that want to offer their testimony, which I think will be real helpful too.
Representative Downey, just was reminded, did you have an oral amendment as well that you were interested in?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. In my discussions with management and budget yesterday, the term that I am using here for job or position description, actually unbeknownst to me, corresponds to a different type of document within state government. What I think is a more appropriate comparative basis is what's called job classification. And so my oral amendment, Mr. Chair, would be in the bill on at least line 1.12, and Mr. Shepherd can tell me if there's any other places where we refer to the term position description to replace that with job classification.
Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair and members, and I'll kind of go through this, and Representative Downey can correct me if it's wrong, and I will write this down as well. But on page, there's changes in the bill and the amendments. In the bill, page 1, line 11, would delete position descriptions and insert job classes. And page 1, line 12, delete position description and insert job class. And on the A3 amendment, this is a question for Representative Downey, I think, that on line 6 of the amendment, where it says duties of the position, it would say duties of the job class. And then on the A4 amendment, on line 7, delete position and insert job class. Line 8, delete position and insert job class. And line 16, delete position and insert job class. And I just ask Representative Downey if that is what he intended.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, that is my intent, and I guess if there's a way when we move the bill to make sure that the next engrossment of the bill would pick up any stray instances where we missed it, that'd be great. But that's my intent, is to change position with job class.
So that's your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
As outlined by Mr. Shepherd. Do you need to have that repeated by Mr. Shepherd? Everybody catch that? If not, all in favor of that oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Now the bill is in the form that the author prefers. Any further comment, Representative Downey, before we open?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, everybody, for indulging me on those amendments to get it tuned up. I appreciate it.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask this before we get into the longer discussion about the bill. Representative Downey, you said that you want to make sure that public sector employees are fairly compensated, and you also said that public sector employees should be compared to private sector employees in terms of compensation. And I guess I think there are a lot of people who would dispute that private sector employees are fairly paid. In fact, there's been a lot of protests around the country on that very issue in the last couple of years. So for me, the question I have is, if you have a collective bargaining process in which employees can join together and bargain with their employer, it's a form of market. And it might not all of the markets might be the same that we're comparing to. So how do you know that comparing a negotiated contract in the public sector is less fair than the wages in the private sector? And what is the value of performing that study? It seems to me that the employer and the employees are the ones who are best able to determine what's fair compensation.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler. I think the purpose of the study is less from the perspective of the folks down here at the Capitol in St. Paul, and perhaps more so for whatever it is, the 80 to 90% of people who don't work in government, for all of us collectively as a state to have a common shared understanding of what that comparison actually is, and to collectively agree that we've got it sized and shaped and priced properly in state government. And I think you, for those of us who pay attention, you'd be hard-pressed to ignore the challenge that we've had politically and all of the argumentation and debate about whether or not we're overcompensating or undercompensating our public sector employees. So I guess maybe fairness is in the eye of the beholder. This attempts to at least put the information out there so that the public, the taxpayers, the folks who pay for everything that goes on down here can participate in that as well with a good set of information to even know what they're talking about.
Representative, we
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up, and we'll get to the testimony. But we're going to hear testimony and a presentation of a report making this comparison. We have studies, I think, that the state has already done, the Hayes study. We've had a workforce report conducted by the state. And if we're just trying to understand and get information, it seems to me that we could use the information we already have instead of spending another $3.1 million or whatever, like somewhere in there, spend another $3 million for a report that would provide new information, maybe, but we seem to have a lot of information already, including from the Taxpayers Association. So I guess I just wonder what if the only point is to get more information or to get information to make a comparison, it seems like we don't need to spend $3 million in order to do that, unless the point is something else.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler. Well, I've been on this committee for 3 years, and I've never seen that information presented in a way that would even come close to trying to answer the question that I think I'm trying to have answered through this bill. So if that information is out there and it's in a form that would somehow satisfy this kind of broad-based question that I'm trying to get answered through this study, I haven't seen it in the 3 years that I've been here.
Further questions from the committee? And we have people who have asked to be heard testify. If there are no further questions at this point from the committee, we will call on the folks in the order in which they've requested. Mr. Habman. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. With me this morning is Aaron Twaite, Research Director for the Association, also one of the co-principal investigators of this project. This project was commissioned by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and NIAP Minnesota in 2009. They had an interest in understanding how state compensation and local government compensation compared to the private sector. What you have before you are just a couple of summary slides based on the findings of our report. Our report actually is significantly broader than just the benchmarking findings that are here. If any of you are interested in looking at both parts of the final report, we'd be happy to provide that to you. What I'd like to do then is just to first highlight a couple of methodological issues associated with the study to help people understand how we approach this. There are two general ways to go about benchmarking compensation. One is a regression-based approach, which is, and there are many studies that have been done on this. Most are regression-based approaches where you sort of take the entire population of the private sector, public sector workforce, and then attempt to control for various features like education experience and things of that nature to derive a estimation of the compensation premium or discount that exists. Another way to approach this is to actually build from the bottom up, which is to actually attempt to assemble data that allows direct apples-to-apples comparisons of similar jobs. Regression-based approaches are more typically used simply because the data to do a sort of direct apples-to-apples comparison oftentimes does not exist. That was not the case here. Mr. Twaite can talk a little bit more about the actual process of matching that we used, but we had access to that information that allowed us to take a bottom-up approach of matching actual positions that we feel very confidently do the same jobs that have equivalent educational and experience requirements associated with them. On the second page, you see a little more detail on the universe of the study that was conducted. We start with about 33,000 state employees. We immediately subtracted all those for which there was no private sector analog. obviously corrections officers, public safety, positions like that, which really don't have an equivalent in the private sector. That eliminates about half the population, leaving us with about 15,000 broadly comparable positions. And then we further refine that universe to tighten our analysis. There were some positions in state government, local government, where the job descriptions just didn't provide us enough comfort level to understand exactly what they did and match that accordingly with someone in the private sector. There are a number of positions that couldn't be adequately matched, especially in the management area, because typically compensation is oftentimes based on issues of budget responsibility and direct reports, and that level of information allowing us to match that with a level of confidence just didn't exist. And finally, we removed a number of full-time equivalent positions for which there weren't that many people. And our concern here, our attempt here was to control for experience. For example, if the state only hired two people for a certain type of position, but both of those people had 35 years of experience, that could easily show a public sector compensation premium, meaning higher than the market when none actually existed if that experience. So by eliminating those positions where the count was relatively low, we felt we could reasonably control for the role of experience in our analysis. When you take all that out, we were left with 41 occupation classes covering about 9,500 employees, or a little bit more than 60% of the possible private sector comparables. I will now turn to the primary findings, wage first, then health care benefits, then retirement, then sort of an overall perspective. The public versus private sector wage findings are actually quite consistent with the large number of studies that have been done on this across the country. And what I mean by that is there's significant deviation from market rates in both directions. When I say wage premiums, what I mean by there is that it's paid more than the counterpart on the other side. So about 60% of occupations that we studied had public sector wage premiums, representing about 72% of the total state workforce analyzed, and the average premium was about 10% on wages. Conversely, of course, 41% had discounts, representing about 28% of the workforce analyzed, and the average wage discount there was 14.7%. About 75% of that discount was confined to a small number of occupations that are typically have very high skill and education requirements and training requirements. You see the list there: engineers, nurses, pharmacists, auditors, attorneys, and management analysts. The next page has sort of a summary which captures the double imbalance, and that phrase comes actually from a study that was done by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago on this issue. And again, this is something that these findings are entirely consistent not only with the 2000 Office of Legislative Auditor report on state compensation, but again, national studies that have been done around the country. And you can see the disparities that exist at certain wage areas. Positions generally less than $50,000, typically you will find higher public sector wages. Conversely, those above $60,000, typically you'll find higher private sector wages. Turning to health benefit findings, again, we took a cost-to-employer basis. Obviously, when you start getting into fringe benefits, there might be significant qualitative differences in the types of benefits being provided between various occupations in the public and private sector. We did not do a qualitative assessment, although I would suggest that a lot of the qualitative differences in terms of benefit generosity are factored into the price of the premiums. There are two pieces of the puzzle here which we analyze. There is, first of all, of course, the cost of the premium itself. We found that there is commonly a higher public sector premium. The public sector health care plans cost more. And the other piece of the puzzle, of course, is the amount of the share between employees and employers in paying that premium. And again, there we found that on average a larger share of the public sector cost being picked up by the employer. when you put those two factors together and adjust for the full-time equivalents, we found a public sector premium in healthcare ranges from about 37 to 41% above private sector counterpart costs. Finally, on the retirement findings, again, we were looking at a cost-to-employer basis, recognizing, of course, that employees themselves will oftentimes differ in the amount of contributions that they give to their retirement plans. But based on a cost-to-employer basis, we found a public sector premium in 30 of the 41 occupations surveyed. And this is obviously the retirement area because there is typically a significantly qualitative difference between the types of retirement plans that you find in the public sector versus the private sector. Of course, public sector retirement plans being predominantly defined benefit-based versus defined contribution-based in the private sector. If you factored in issues such as the unfunded liabilities and the required contributions to restore these to wholeness, there might the numbers might change fairly dramatically. But again, the qualitative considerations are significant. Included in our report is an attempt to actually compare a defined benefit plan offered in the in state and local government to a imaginary annuity based on a 401k plan, sort of an equivalent annuity analysis. How much would a 401k have to generate the same benefits that exist in that are available through the various state and local defined benefit plans? Again, that information is available in the report itself. Finally, from a total compensation perspective, when you add all these pieces of the puzzle together, we found that about 70% of the employees, including the study, have total compensation at least 5% better than the private sector counterparts. 10% have total compensation costs at least 5% lower than the private sector. And about 18% have total compensation costs, which are largely reflective of private center counterparts, meaning plus or minus about 5% of what the private sector offers. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the study.
Questions from the committee? Representative Kahn.
A couple of questions. It seems to me that there are certain public jobs that are just totally incomparable, like DNR game wardens and state patrol people. And what about this paragraph from the OLA study in 2000, which says that as a group, state employees are paid more than private sector employees because the state workforce contains a higher concentration of professional workers and a lower concentration of sales craft and assembly line positions. According to data from the current population study, 37.5% of state employees work in professional occupations compared to 12.4% of private sector employees. Within the private sector, so many more people employed in sales craft or assembly line positions.
Mr. Haven?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, that becomes an issue in regression-based modeling when you're actually attempting to, when you're comparing very dissimilar populations of employees. This, because we built from the ground up, we are matching professionals with professionals, blue-collar with blue-collar, positions with positions. So I think the OLA comment is spot on, but it doesn't, I don't think at all, conflict with the findings of our study.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Part of the problem is one of the things we're seeing more and more is some of those people in those very low-level private positions. Well, I'll just refer people to this excellent article that was in the New York Times this Sunday, which took someone complaining about government spending, someone in Minnesota, actually, I think Lindstrom or Chisholm or someone, something like that, Lindstrom, I think, complaining about government spending, and then specifically listing all the government programs he was taking advantage of, which is free meals for his kids and the earned income tax credit and, of course, Medicare for his elderly mother and so forth. But what about the fact that more and more we're seeing that some of these low-level private sector employees are dependent on public programs to basically conduct their lives. Isn't that then a public cost that should be attributed back to the private sector?
Mr. Haben?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, there are certainly an abundance of value judgments associated with this.
That's not a value judgment.
No, no.
That's a number judgment.
The scope of our study was looking at the cost of compensation. Clearly, there are issues pertaining to, you know, the adequacy of that compensation, but that is, our study was just, we were asked to look at, compare these two, what are the results from a cost of compensation perspective.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop here, but I think I'm pointing out how inadequate that is in looking at the real life situation of costs to the state and costs to the public.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Haveman. I think one of the key questions today is, are we, when we compare these public and private sector, are we making legitimate comparisons? Is it apples to apples, apples to oranges, or whatever? And my question is, discounting compensation, what do you feel are the major differences in the jobs? Is it educational attainment, or what?
Mr. Haveman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you asking what, when we do find the differences, what are the sources of those differences? Was that the, I apologize.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's okay. I confuse myself with my questions sometimes, too. But basically, it's what, you know, discounting that they are paid differently, as you pointed out, how are the jobs different?
Mr. Haben?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, I guess I might turn to Mr. Twaite for some discussion of the confidence and the approach that we used in matching. Again, we there are obviously some subjective assessments that are made in comparing job descriptions, which is essentially what we did. Looked at what these people do, just job descriptions and what their activities entail. And our efforts, by culling out significant numbers of employees in the process, we felt we took a quite conservative approach to that culling exercise, so that we felt reasonably confident that the people that we are comparing are pretty much doing the same thing, whether it's in the public sector or in the private sector. And maybe I'll just turn to Mr. Twaite for any further comment on that.
Mr. Twaite, please identify yourself for the record.
Of course. My name is Aaron Twaite. I'm the research director for the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, the process that we went through when we put together this study in terms of matching private sector and public sector employment. Minnesota Management and Budget publishes numerous position descriptions that describe the jobs that the state offers and that they where they have employment. We match those up with information from the federal government on employment by job position, essentially. And those come with position descriptions. We were very careful to try to match things that we thought, when we looked at the position description in the federal data and the position description that was provided by MMB, that people, incumbents in those positions, would do the same or similar work. And really, we eliminated a number of positions that could have been matched, but where we just were unhappy with where we would not have been comfortable including it in the study.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haveman, as I understand the study that's requested in the bill, it's basically asking to compare job classifications in state government to job classifications in the private sector. Is that that what your report has done?
Mr. Haberman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, to some extent, I have no doubts that a firm that specializes in this area could be encompass many more types of positions and do more detailed analysis than we were able to do. I'm not a human resource management expert, so when you start getting to issues of classification versus position versus things of that nature, I'm not sure if I can answer that accurately. Again, we felt fairly strongly that for the positions that we could match up, and I don't know if that qualifies as class or not, that you know, our analysis was based on being able to match those positions. I suspect they're a professional firm who, you know, either has their own data or just has been, you know, significantly more involved in explorations of these nature, could substantially encompass a much broader population and maybe drill down even a little deeper than we were able to do.
Representative Winkler?
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Haberman, I guess that means that the study could be done better, you think, but the basic concept of comparing positions to positions is something you've already done, this study.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, yes, I think we've provided a head start on the type of thing that would be done in the context of the broader study.
Okay, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Haberman, I'm looking at your last slide, and it says 71% of employees included in the study, and I just want to make sure I'm connecting the dots here, but you said roughly half of state employees are not included in your study because there is no comparable position.
That is correct. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, that's correct.
So I guess another way of looking at your slide is that 35% of all state employees you think are making more than the private sector, 5% of state employees are making less, 9% are at market, and half we don't know because there's nothing to compare.
Mr. Haberman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I trust your math on that, but I'm guessing it's...
Divide by two, I think I can even handle that.
Yeah.
but I just want to make sure that the logical connection works here. Okay. Mr. Chair, and so I guess what I question is, if you have a study looking at positions of employees and half of them are taken out at the beginning, it suggests that your data set that you're looking at is the question that you're asking about the data set you have is of limited value. If you have to immediately exclude half of it because it's not comparable, to me it suggests that the other half in some ways is also not comparable. Unless you can give us a sense of who the half that you measured are, what kind of positions are these, to understand how they match up, because otherwise I just question the value of spending $3 million to perfect a study that's already been done for a group of people where half of them don't even compare. So, can you give us any comfort that the other half that were studied are a good match to the private sector? Because it seems to me the data set doesn't really line up with the private sector comparison.
Mr. Haberman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, in the report, in answer to your question about what we matched up, we've identified all the SOC codes so you can sort of see exactly who we compared with. To your broader question, I would leave that to the professionals who maybe research this area in for a living. They may have some capabilities, some analytical possibilities that we just didn't have access to. We feel very strongly that for the subpopulation of the folks that we did study, these are very, you know, strong and robust and accurate results. There's, of course, the permanent issue that exists that a lot of the types of positions that are hired within government don't have a natural private sector analog. How to go about that, I'm sure, has been discussed at length by professionals who engage in this area as a course of their professional activities. That's where, you know, we would have to hand the ball off in a broader investigation of this nature to a to a professional firm that specializes in this.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Haberman, you do think that your results are strong, robust, and accurate? I think that's what you said?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and testifiers, some of what I wanted to say has kind of been said, but the variation I would have is, I mean, kind of adding on to what has been said, I guess, going the other direction, is what, you know, a lot of the private sector companies don't offer health care. A lot of them are part-time. So say, are you, you know, you got like a Walmart society where people aren't having health care. So is that, how can you leave these people out, or are you figuring the true costs of that to our society? I mean, that's what I think Representative Kahn was trying to say. Are you adding that back in? So say you have an employee that's outside that is, whether they don't have the opportunity to work full-time or don't have the health care benefits, are you just ignoring that and that 50% that Representative Winkler's talking about, or you're just, I mean, that's the public worker side that you're ignoring, or the public workers, but are you doing the same thing on the other side? Are you ignoring those folks that are off the grid, perhaps?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think I'm going to have to turn it over to Mr. Tweit. I know our analysis attempted to control for that by focusing, if I remember correctly, on employees that have 75% or more of full-time equivalents with health care. I'm going to have to turn it over to Mr. Tweit for some clarification on addressing that.
Thank you.
Mr. Tweit?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lilly. The numbers that we used for the health care costs for the private employers come from the MEPS data set. And we used the numbers that are reported by establishments where 75% or more of the employees work on a full-time basis. There was no data set that they publish that, you know, specifically segregated employees that have health care versus employees that don't have health care. The best proxy that we could find was establishments where 3/4 or more of the employees work on a full-time basis. That provides probably the best, the most, the set of employees where most reasonably they would be offered some sort of health care benefit.
Mr. Chair. Well, I just, personally, I just think this is flawed. I mean, you know, people need health care. I mean, it's kind of a roundabout way that people aren't getting full-time employment, and that's one of the things I think we've done that is probably right, is that we offer people decent jobs and decent livings, and I think at the end of the study, if you'll find out that they're not overcompensated, but they're probably justly, you know, they're fairly treated and can earn a living wage. I just worry about some of these things where you're not including real data. We've got a society that's failing. We've got people that are working not full times or working multiple jobs, and I don't know how you're factoring all that in. And people that are off the grid, you know, and not, I don't know. Anyways, I'll continue to listen, but thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Haberman, you talked about studying 41 job classes. Do you know how many job classes there are in state government?
Mr. Haberman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not offhand. Maybe Mr. Tweit.
Mr. Tweit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier, looking at the fiscal note provided by MMB, it looks like it's approximately 1,800.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's 1,400 plus job classes in state government, and so we're looking at 41, and then we're trying to apply that to state employees. And my concern is, you know, when you say apples to apples, I would guess you're probably comparing a Braeburn apple with a Red Delicious or a Granny Smith, and I have some issues with that, you know, because they're unique. You know, a clerical person, perhaps in DHS, doesn't do anything compared to a legislative assistant, other than maybe have a computer. I mean, you could argue that they're both clerical, but, you know, we all know our LAs are more than that. And I would bet that a clerical person in DHS is more than just a clerical person or a data entry person. And so I see real trouble trying to compare job classes based on a description. You know, I used to, as a rehab director, I had 60 employees under me, and what the job description was and what the job in reality was wasn't always the same, because my employees did more than what was expected. And so I have some problems taking this 41 job classes out of 1,400 and trying to make a statement about state employees. I just don't think you have enough data, and I'm not sure this study that Representative Downing, my good friend, is offering up today, is going to be able to do it too.
Mr. Hibben?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, many of these job classes are, if I understand correctly, subclasses within a type of occupation. And of course, you will find that same range of experience within the private sector, although it's not classified as Mechanical Engineer 1, Mechanical Engineer 2, Mechanical Engineer 3. So we still are able to compare the skills and responsibilities and activities with a typical specific type of position with the private sector, but capture more, you know, classes as a result. And again, I would draw your attention to that even with those, that limitation of 41 occupational classes rather than job classes, which I think is what we're talking about here, we are capturing about 60% of what we feel is the possible private sector counterparts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gauthier.
So, Mr. Havman, you are admitting then that you are comparing Braeburns with Granny Smiths and Red Delicious.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know if I'm willing to yield on that. I will. There certainly is in a job description, even on a firm by firm basis, you're going to have extraordinary diversity in terms of, you know, what the daily activities of that position might be. But if you are capturing what this person does, and most of these positions, we culled most of the positions out of the analysis where high levels of that subjectivity would likely introduce itself. And that is, as I said, particularly true in the management area. We would immediately yield that, you know, comparing managers in the public sector versus private sector would be an extraordinarily difficult challenge, and you know, making compensation judgments on something like that, simply because of the direct reports, budgetary responsibilities, things of that nature, just absolutely unknown. But most of the positions that we're talking about here are quite carefully defined, recognizing again that there's going to be some diversity in any type of job in terms of the duties and responsibilities on a day-to-day basis, but these are pretty clear delineation of the types of positions that exist, and as I said, we feel quite confident that it's a reasonable comparison.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, we just
in follow up.
Yeah, can we need to get on to the other testifiers as well, so please go ahead.
Well, then my question would be, or my statement would be, I guess, is if there's such diversity in the private sector as in a job classification as you seem to think there is in state government, there's probably wide diversity of compensation also then. I guess that's more of a statement than a question.
We have Representative Moline and then Representative Banyan, and then we're going to move to the other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, in your study, did you study private for-profit or private non-profit?
Mr. Twait, Mr. Hammond?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it was all private sector. All right, yeah.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, don't businesses usually try to reduce or eliminate costs if that's not profitable to their business?
Mr. Hibben?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would agree with that.
And thanks,
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, and so then did you take that into account that, you know, in the public sector, a lot of our employees are mandated to serve clients that could really never be profitable in the private sector? Did you take that into consideration, that businesses reduce or eliminate costs that are not profitable?
Mr. Hibben?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there's really no analysis included in this report that examines the difference in actions or management activities done within the public or private sector. What this, again, the scope of this investigation was limited to, you have these people that do largely, if not totally, the same types of activities in the private versus sector versus public sector. How's the compensation system look like? How does the compensation systems compare?
Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll try to be brief since I know we have a lot of other testifiers, so maybe we can get into the details on that and how some of these could actually be compared. Child protection services is one thing that I can think of off mine. I'm just not sure how that could ever be compared public to private. But my final question is, who paid for this study and were you paid to conduct this study?
Mr. Haben?
Mr. Chairman, a representative, as I said at the beginning, it was commissioned by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and NIAP Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, did the Minnesota Taxpayers League get paid by the Chamber to conduct this study?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we are not the Taxpayers League of Minnesota. I just want to make sure you understand that. We are the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, two different organizations. Yes, we received a contract to do this investigation. Yes.
Representative Banyan, and then we're going to move to other testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Lanning. I wish I could take 20 minutes to do sampling theory with application to apples, but I'll spare you all that. Let me just give a couple questions and then a comment, because I've got two things that I need to know about your study. First of all, was turnover at all a consideration in the? Did you study anything regarding turnover of public and private sector jobs?
Mr. Haben?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, no, we did not.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right. Well, one thing that happens is that turnover matters, right? And turnover matters because, you know, when people take a job, they are looking for certain packages, including pay, health, retirement, the kinds of things that Representative Lilly was talking about. He's quite right about that. So my second question to you is, did you do anything to indicate whether the job classifications where you might have seen a public sector discount in, say, wages was offset by a public sector premium in some other area? Okay, was there any correlation across the 41 classes between those three areas? Did you make any study of that?
Mr. Haben?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, we did do a bit of analysis on that, and my recollection is that I believe there were seven or eight occupations whose total compensation package tipped from discount to premium when the benefits were added, meaning from a wage basis, the wage in the public sector was a discount. But then when you factored in the health care benefits and the retirement benefits, it flipped them over into the into the premium column, as it were. I would have to double check on that, but I think there was about seven of those positions that we identified here that fell into that category. Certainly less than 10. I know it's less than 10.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just put a comment to that, and then I'll stop. I think that's a very important point. Okay, and I would like to see those. I'd like to actually see those results at some point, because When you think about it, it's one of the things we heard, and I'm remembering this from our committee last year, Mr. Chairman. I think it was Interim Commissioner Salamone from Revenue talking about the difficulty in keeping auditors, for example, performing audits, because there was a lot of job turnover there. Young guys were coming in, they're getting trained in the public sector and then moving on. Well, some folks stay, and who are those folks? I think they tend to be folks people that have a particular preference for the type of packages we offer within the public sector, and those packages are qualitatively different than they are in the private sector. So, as we look at this study, and I commend Representative Downey for bringing the bill here, because it starts a conversation about what are the types of packages offered in the public sector and the private sector. I think there's an importance to looking at the totality of these packages and not just consider wages, not just consider health benefits, not just consider retirement packages, but to look at the totality of them. And I think your study got us part the way there, but I do think we need to know more. I'll come back and reserve some comments about fiscal notes and so on when we get to that point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, gentlemen, for being here with us today. We will now move to the other testifiers. Next on the list is Elliot Side. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Elliot Side. I'm the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before this committee. I appreciate that opportunity. Mr. Chairman Lanning and members of the committee, again, my name is Elliot Side, and as I indicated, I am the Executive Director of AFSCME Council 5. For clarification, we're a union of 43,000 workers who advocate for excellence in public services, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all workers. AFSCME represents 18,000 state employees who would be harmed by House File 2033, Representative Downey's so-called Pay Equity and Benefits Act. It's much more than a simple study to compare the wages and benefits of public sector workers with private sector workers. Make no mistake about it, this bill would turn Minnesota into Governor Scott Walker's Wisconsin. It would supersede Minnesota's Public Employee Relations Act and harm unionized state employees by rolling back pay equity, stripping their collective bargaining rights, and preventing any new negotiated contract from being implemented, even with the amendments. Representative Downey wants state employee contracts to be legislated instead of negotiated. That's an overreach, and it's bad public policy. We negotiate our wages, benefits, and working conditions with the executive branch. After union members ratify their contract, it goes to the legislature for approval. That's a thumbs up or thumbs down vote, not an opportunity to change the collectively bargained agreement. Representative Downey figures the private marketplace is the cure for all ills. But no private employer would waste money on this kind of compensation study of its entire workforce. External comparisons are often used to recruit or retain a CEO. But it's impossible to analyze an entire workforce with thousands of job classifications. What's most important to any employer, private or public, is the recruitment and retention of the best and brightest and most capable employees. If that's what Representative Downey wants, he should stop referring to the state workforce as a beast that must be starved. He should stop trying to drive down wages and benefits for state employees who are struggling paycheck to paycheck like most Minnesotans. And he should stop threatening to privatize our jobs if they're listed in the yellow pages. What private CEO would publicly bash and threaten his workforce the way the representative does? Last session, Representative Downey and his allies showed state employees what they think we're worth. First, they indicated they would cut the state workforce by 15%. That's 5,000 fewer workers. And by the way, in AFSCME bargaining units, we are down 1,006 employees from September to September. That's how many people who lost jobs in that period of time. So they wanted 5,000 fewer workers. And then if what we've referred to as cheap labor conservatives had their way with us, the average AFSCME state employee who still has a job would qualify for food stamps. And let me make sure that that's empirically accurate with you. First, they'd freeze our pay for 2 years and eliminate our right to bargain and strike. That was a bill by Representative Driskowski. Then they'd hold back 5% of our income for performance pay. And if the boss doesn't like you, it's a $1,900 pay cut for the average AFSCME member who earns $38,000 a year. Then our right to bargain was attacked, bargain health care. They'd have us pay 60% of our health insurance premium, or $7,195 for family coverage, but plus $4,000 for out-of-pocket expenses. And then our retirement security was attacked. They'd have us contribute 2% more to our pension so the employer can pay 2% less. That was a bill by Representative Franson. That shift is a $760 pay cut for the average AFSCME member. So tack on a property tax hike that all Minnesotans, including our members, will pay, state and federal taxes, Social Security, and Medicare withholdings. The average AFSCME member who earns $38,000 a year would have only $13,645 to live on. That state employee would then qualify for food stamps. Here are some facts that bust the myths you hear about the public sector. First, Minnesota's government workforce is the seventh leanest in the nation, according to a new study released this week by Gallup, and I've got a copy of it. It's listed here. Only 12.7% of all Minnesota workers worked for state, federal, and local governments in 2011. AFSCME members earn, on average, $38,000 a year. Most of us are struggling paycheck to paycheck with frozen wages, just like the average Minnesota worker. Public workers in Minnesota earn 8% less, not more, 8% less in total compensation than our counterparts in the private sector when matched by education experience. Total compensation includes wages plus benefits. That's a study that was done by the Economic Policy Institute by Professor Jeffrey Keefe, an expert in human resources. And full disclosure, Economic Policy Institute gets donations from our national union, AFSCME, but this study was not commissioned by AFSCME. This is done by Professor Keefe. But we have two other studies that have nothing to do with the Economic Policy Institute that will also demonstrate, and we'll be happy to have our staff share that with you, that public sector workers make on average 8% less than their counterparts. AFSCME retirees have modest pension benefits of about $13,000 a year. Combined with Social Security, it's the difference between dignity and poverty, and the way that we don't have to depend on other government spending to be able to survive. The average AFSCME member who spends an entire career in public service retires with less than $10,000 in severance for unused vacation and sick leave. Payments to AFSCME members averaged $3,587 for unused sick time during the past 3 years, according to a Pioneer Press report. Public sector workers at all pay levels have sick leave and vacation benefits comparable to private sector workers in large employers, and in particular the higher paid private sector workers. And that's a key point. If we're going to compare apples and apples, this is a large enterprise, and it ought to be compared with job classes in other large enterprises, not in smaller enterprises. That's a critical part methodologically of doing an accurate study. Bottom line, the public sector has much less benefit and equity than the private sector. Calls to make the public sector more like the private sector are calls to increase the wage and benefit inequities in the state and this nation. The top 1% is pushing this agenda, and it's bad for the 99%. The golden parachutes paid to Minnesota CEOs like United Health's William McGuire and 3M's George Buckley far exceed the amount the state pays to all employees in any year. One person gets a golden parachute more than all the state employees in the state of Minnesota in any 1 year. One person. So I suppose that when we do comparability, we're also going to pay the governor and all the managers that kind of inequitable compensation that we now have in the private sector in this country. Historically, Minnesotans have wanted their government to reflect their ideals and serve as a model for the private sector to follow. In 1982, for example, Minnesota was the first to provide pay equity for state government workers. Today, women in state employment finally earn $1 for every dollar paid to male employees in comparable jobs. It took 29 years, 29 years too long. And now Representative Downey wants to roll back pay equity for 20,000 women who work in state government. The gender gap that disappeared in our state government still exists in the private sector, where women's earnings are 77% of men's. Instead of scrapping pay equity in the public sector, we should be erasing wage discrimination against women in the private sector. We should not return to the days of discrimination against women in employment and discrimination against women in wages. And in fact, that is what Representative Downey's public policy will do. Public service isn't just a job. It's a calling to make real differences in our communities. Public workers teach our kids, heal the sick, protect our communities, plow our roads, clean our water, and much more. It's time for Representative Downey to stop denigrating us and pitting the private sector against the public sector. After all, public workers create an environment in which the public sector can thrive. We build infrastructure. We educate kids. We create an economic environment that business wants to live in and a quality of life where businesses want to locate here. We've already proven that we can partner with the Dayton administration to improve service delivery. A year ago, Governor Dayton asked the Department of Natural Resources and the Pollution Control Agency to accelerate and simplify their permitting process to allow more rapid business expansion and job creation. Today, both those agencies have issued and approved 99% of their permits in less than 150 days. That process involved AFSCME members who work on the front lines serving business customers. Their bosses treated them with respect and asked for their input and cooperation. That was a real solution to a real problem, not a solution in search of a problem. Public workers want their government to be as good as its people. To achieve that success, Representative Downey and his allies should withdraw House File 2033 and end this war on workers. You can't make government work better by beating up on the workforce. I'll be happy to take questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan. I'm sorry, Representative Benson is first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Slide, I think you quoted in your testimony that your research showed that public sector was actually paid about 8% below private sector.
Correct.
If we did a study and it confirmed that, wouldn't you be the first person in here to this committee to say that we should use that as an element in our negotiations for increasing the pay for public workers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, there are studies. We just heard one. I shared another one with you. I can share two more with you. At the end of the day, I would think what any company wants, or the state of Minnesota, is to attract and retain the best possible workers. And it's interesting to me that with this fixation that the market cures all ills, that we don't let the market do that here. We want the best and most capable employees in state government. And the way we get them is to offer comparable, competitive packages that attract those workers into state government so that the people of Minnesota get the best possible service. And I don't understand why we want to turn the marketplace over to a $3 million bureaucratic attempt to try to fix something on paper.
Representative Benson?
So is that a yes?
I think the study is a waste of time and a waste of money, sir. Mr. Chairman, sir.
Representative Benson.
I'd like to ask whether or not, now, when you're going to go into negotiations, do you hire any studies at all to show compensation trends and any resources at all that would help you in your negotiations to get the best salaries possible?
Of course, we look at compensation.
Go through the chair.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. I know better than that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson. Mr. Chairman, I apologize to you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson. Yes, we do comparables. We're trying to compete in a marketplace. We're trying to make sure that our packages are competitive and that can attract the best possible folks. We do that. And the collective bargaining process, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, is what that give and take between management and labor is what finally sets a number that everyone can live with.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Seid, do you see any difference at all in the state doing this study as a way to prepare themselves? I mean, I think we've had amendments today that kind of really waters this down as an attempt, as a frontal attack on the labor unions. And I see it more of this is another piece, a toolkit piece, if you will, for the state to show before they go into bargaining, just as you do, to make sure that they are offering a correct compensation, higher or lower. It could be the fact that we're paying a significant portion of our state employees less than they should. But don't you see this as part and parcel similar to what you already do?
Mr. Seid?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson. I would assume I've been bargaining contracts now for a while, and I bargained three contracts with Governor Plenty's administration, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, and now I'm bargaining one with the Dayton administration. I would assume that the employer is also already doing that work. And so everyone's doing that work, so I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, what benefit we get by spending $3 million more. And this bill doesn't just do a study. Let's be clear about that, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, and even the amendment doesn't do that. It stops the implementation of any collective bargaining agreement that doesn't agree with the study. And so, I mean, what we ought to be doing is allowing the collective bargaining process to work so that we can set rates that attract and retain the best possible workers.
Representative Benson?
Could you clearly show me in the amendment or the bill where it shows that it stops collective bargaining?
Mr. Seid?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just asking Julie Boyle to join me. I missed the beginning of the amendments, but I did take a look at them, and I believe it says notwithstanding 179A, it supersedes PELRA. That the that there's language in this that supersedes PELRA, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Shepard, you want to clarify?
Mr. Chair and members, the subdivision 3 on page 2, lines 3 to 9, was deleted from the bill in one of Representative Downey's amendments.
I believe
Mr. Seid, it was deleted from the bill.
I believe that that in the implementation that I looked at, that the implementation also says that a collective bargaining agreement cannot be implemented.
Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, and again, this is it's somewhat difficult to piece together all of the language here, but the language that in the original bill that specifically prohibited implementing collective bargaining agreements has been removed. Everything that was on page 1, line 20 to page 2, line 9 is out of the bill and was replaced by the language in the A4 amendment, which is on line page 1, line 10 to 19 of the A4 amendment, which would require reporting to specified legislative officials before entering into a new contract or collective bargaining agreement in which compensation is different from that under the report.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Benson, Representative Downey, so the amendment then withdraws any reference to 179A or any interference with the collective bargaining process
Representative
at all?
It does, Mr. Seid, and so I wondered if you wanted to correct your testimony to the fact that it interferes with collective bargaining.
No, I actually don't want to change my testimony at all. Let me just read to you part of the amendment that I read, Mr. Chairman. Subdivision 2 moves to amend HF 2033 as follows. Subdivision 2, reporting of compensation differences. An appointing authority in the legislative branch of the Commissioner of Management, Budget, Executive Branch employees must report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the Senate Finance and House Ways and Means Committees before entering into a new contract or collective bargaining agreement or implementing a compensation plan in which the compensation for position is different from the redesigned compensation reported under Subdivision 1. A report under the subdivision for each position describe the difference in compensation between the redesigned compensation reported under Subdivision 1 and the proposed compensation under the contract, collective bargaining agreement, or compensation plan. So it directly interferes and interrupts the collective bargaining process in the amendment as well. The collective bargaining process, Mr. Chairman and Representative Benson, has worked in this state. We have a state that has had peaceful labor relations for close to 30 years. And this, even the amendment, interferes with the collective bargaining process. It seems to me that, Mr. Chairman, that any competent employer negotiator is going to look at comparables in order to do their bargaining. And we're going to bargain about what exists in a real environment, what the real economic environment is. And that process can be informed by research. It always is informed by research. But it need not be interrupted or interfered with by another body.
Representative Benson?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Seid, I guess we're going to agree to disagree, but I didn't hear anything in the amendment that you read that would actually interfere with the collective bargaining process. I've negotiated contracts, and there was nothing in there short of just saying that we need to get a report. Rather, there was nothing in there at all about interfering with the collective bargaining agreement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, again, I guess we will agree to disagree, but when I read language that says that before entering into a new contract or collective an appointing authority in the legislative branch or the commissioner of management and budget for the executive branch must report to the chairs before entering into a new contract or collective bargaining agreement or implementing a compensation plan in which the compensation for position is different from the redesigned compensation reported under subdivision A, that a contract can't be entered into, contract bargaining must stop until that's done, I'd say that's interfering in the collective bargaining process, Mr. Chairman, and I guess we will agree to disagree.
Representative Banyan, and then we need to move on to the next testifier.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, Mr. Side, I'm going to take up your offer on the other studies. I kind of read them as a part of my professional curiosity anyway. So I'd like to have them. They'll make good breakfast time reading.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, we'd be happy to share those.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Do you know if they're all regression type studies, as I believe the Keefe one is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, off the top of my head, no, I don't. I did read the other two studies. That was last year, and I'm sorry, sir, I've forgotten. Okay. Mr. Chairman, sir, I've forgotten the methodology in those studies.
Okay.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Well, that's a different methodology than the methodology in the Haveman study, and that's one of the questions we have going on here, and maybe why we need someone else to come take a look at this. Have any of your members ever left for the private sector due to wages?
Mr. Syed? Oh.
Mr. Chairman, most certainly. I mean, we've had, in fact, in the Department of Transportation, in the TSS series, we were doing exactly, Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, what you described in the auditor series. Mm-hmm. We were training up people to do inspection work and work on the roads. They were not getting compensated enough. There was a revolving door. We would get people in at entry. They would never get up to the next levels because they left to go work in the private sector. And in fact, under Governor Pawlenty, in the Department of Transportation, and you can check this, Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, with Commissioner Searle, that in fact the department actually asked the union to negotiate increased wages for the TSS series because they could not retain workers after training them. They would train up all these workers to do the work, inspection work and design work on the road, and then they would lose them to private sector companies. So I believe it was the contract before last. We actually did an equity adjustment in that classification because we could no longer attract and retain workers. And I guess that's my point, Mr. Chairman. The process works to retain and recruit our workers rather than train them and lose them.
Thank you. Thank you. One more question, please, Mr. Chairman. And then I'll move on. We can move on. What contract are you currently negotiating, please? What is the start date of that contract, to be precise?
Mr. Chairman, we're negotiating a successor agreement for 2011-2013.
And so, Mr. Chairman, my question relates to Representative Benson's question. The bill calls for a report to be done by March 15th and reported out by July 1st of 2013. You're still working on a contract for 2011 or 2013. It's currently 2012. I'm curious how that report being done by that time would have interfered in the process of negotiation when you probably would still be negotiating that 2013-2015 contract at that time.
Mr. Syed?
Mr. Chairman, it would clearly interfere with the next collective bargaining agreement and the process therein. Again, I think we have a solution in search of a problem, Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, in the sense that, again, I believe a management department does some research on comps. I believe we do some research on comps, and then we sit down together and try to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement involving another party to interfere with that process, to stop that process, or in any way change that process. It's not going to. Doesn't seem to me to add any value. I think that's the main point. What value does it add?
Excuse me, Chair Lanning. What was the date on which you completed negotiations on the three contracts that you negotiated with Governor Pawlenty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, they were different dates depending on the state shutdown. If Mr. Chairman, Representative Banyan, you may remember we did have a state shutdown this year, and we didn't get started into negotiations until much later this year. We didn't even get started really till September. Traditionally, we've gotten started in March. We try to be finished by June. In 2005, during the state shutdown, we didn't complete the contract until the fall. In previous sets of negotiations, there were years in which we didn't complete contracts until fall. This is the furthest we've gone without a successor agreement, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I asked about the Pawnee contracts rather than the current one, but I'll just have to go find that information for myself. Thank you.
Members, we've got three more testifiers, and as a courtesy to them, we want to give them a chance to be heard. Thank you, Mr. Seid, Ms. Blyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity.
And we are going to vote on this bill today, so we've only got 20 minutes left in our meeting. Next on the list is Patty Tangi. So with three of you left, we've got, it's going to be less than 5 minutes each. So you please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Patty Tangi. I am here to represent the Pay Equity Coalition of Minnesota. Good morning, Chair Lanning and members of the committee. I'll keep my my remarks very brief here. I just wanted to make sure that we are all aware of our current state pay equity laws and how they might work as the study goes forward. But a little bit about the Pay Equity Coalition that was formed in the 80s in order to educate the public and our state elected officials about inequities in the market-based wage-setting practices in Minnesota and, of course, throughout the country. So we oppose House File 2033, and the main reason we oppose House File 23 is that the gender bias that is inherent in all market-based salary surveys. Of course, they're not intentional, and they simply reflect the fact that in the labor force, where job segregation is the norm, women's work like library, nursing, clerical, and service is often underpaid when skill, effort, working condition, and responsibility are taken into consideration. So our State Pay Equity Act that was passed in 1982 addresses this fact and requires a gender-neutral analysis of all job descriptions and sets wages accordingly. By establishing equal pay for work of equal value, pay equity corrects historical practices of paying women less for work performed in the public sector employees. Women may perform jobs with different duties than jobs performed by men, but if the male and female jobs are equally valuable to the organization, to our state government, they are paid comparably. And market studies do not reflect this kind of rigor, fairness, or accountability. So the benefits of the state government pay equity practices requires the equitable compensation relationship. Other terms for equitable comparable compensation relationships are comparable worth or pay equity. The state's pay equity laws eliminate sex-based wage disparities in public employment. Equitable compensation relationships are achieved when compensation for female-dominated classes are consistently paid below compensation for male-dominated classes. And the state compensation practices identifies instances where females may be paid less than males through their job evaluation ratings, indicating that females should be paid equal to males. So, in other words, sometimes a clerk may be paid, a job may be rated at 275, and the maintenance position may be rated at 213. And our laws make sure that they're paid comparably, even though their point values are off. Typical inequities include clerical workers who are compared to maintenance workers, and of course all market-based salaries surveys do not compensate for the pay practices that where these types of biases are inherent. So for that reason, we do not support House File 2033, and thank you so much for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Tangi. Next on the list is John Pollard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Pollard. I'm the Legislative and Communications Director for the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget. Most of our concerns have already been discussed, so we'll skip right to two more. I just wanted to add two more implementation concerns that the committee should be aware of that MMB has. The first is that the bill would study total compensation, and we've spoken to some of the consultants that would do this type of work, and while they admit that salary data is readily available in the private sector, benefits data is often not readily available. It's much harder to compile, and the committee should be aware of that. Private companies do not freely share their benefits packages that obviously could range from health and vacation benefits to stock options or bonuses. And so that type of analysis is much more extensive and more difficult to do. And then secondly, Mr. Chairman, we greatly appreciate Representative Downey's recognition that several public sector job classifications do not have a private sector counterpart. However, we did want to reiterate the complexities of comparing the two. As an example, in both the public and private sector, we may have something like a master plumber. And so therefore, one might think that you can easily go to the private sector and compare those two master plumber positions. However, the public sector master plumber may also be responsible for overseeing a work crew of inmates of the Department of Corrections, and therefore they are not comparable positions. So at face value, they appear to be, but in the end, they may not, and we just thought the committee should be aware that sometimes it's a lot more difficult than one might think. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson has a question.
Mr. Pollard, isn't this something that MMB could embark upon without legislation? I mean, couldn't you, if you were so inclined, embark on this very study to help you understand the differences? I mean, there's implications and questions have been asked regarding, you know, helping with the turnover of in specific jobs and something. I just want to find out, isn't this something actually you could embark upon and do yourself? And with the same things that are being mentioned in the bill, make these reports available to the entities that are identified before an agreement is made?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, as was mentioned previously, we do quite a bit of work required by the legislature on salaries, and much of that data is already public. We certainly could do this work without legislation if we could somehow find the time and the resources to do that. I mean, obviously, a $3 million cost or somewhere in that ballpark is a considerable amount of money for a small agency of 250 people.
Thank you, Mr. Pollard. Next on the list is Dana Wheeler. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Dana Wheeler. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Government Engineering Council, representing about 1,000 of your state employees in the engineering specialist and land surveying radio engineering fields, with members from maybe 10 agencies across the state. I'm going to try to modify my remarks because I understand the bill has been modified from what I saw this morning. And so bear with me if there's something that you want to address, please just feel free to ask questions. In general, the engineers support a study of compensation and total compensation. In fact, not only do we support it, we jointly conducted a study in 2008, which is being repeated in 2012, hopefully to be submitted shortly. That study was one in which we wanted to look at total compensation. So we looked at not only wages and insurances, the obvious first ones, but everything from on-call pay, hazard pay, bonuses. By the way, many of these things are things we don't have, but we wanted to look at every form of compensation or benefit, a cell phone, a company vehicle that we could dream of that would exist in either the public sector, which could be federal, state, city, or county, or quasi-public, and the private sector. Secondly, we wanted our survey not to be one in which we compared people who did work that in no way was related either to the work we did or to the work that the state has done. We have the advantage of not representing 1,400 classifications, but rather maybe a dozen. And so it was easier to specify not only the class specification, but what the other study didn't look at was also then the position descriptions, because a class specification is used by MMB as a broad category that talks about generally what does this work do. Position descriptions or job postings get more specific. Each job may vary. Some postings will require, of the same exact classification, will require more education or more experience, or they may zone in on one particular field. It could be civil engineering or mechanical engineering. So we attempted in our survey to provide everyone who was answering the survey with exactly the criteria, not only class specs, but a little more information, so that they could draw a comparison and say if, yes, we have someone who does that same work, or no, we don't. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that we were comparing ourselves with other people who do business for the state. So the surveys, in addition to being sent out to other public sectors surrounding us, cities and largest cities, counties, and nearby states, we sent it to those people who already contract for the state. We didn't send it to private companies who don't contract for the state because, frankly, when we did this study initially, the goal was not are we being compensated fairly. We had a concern about that. But the goal was going into the deficits we're facing, who should best be doing the work and get the most work done for the state. And is that us or is it not? So we feel that our study provides information that's specifically relevant to the work that you need done and as a fair comparison of equal classes. Like several other studies that have been mentioned today and that you can find out there, you'll certainly see that there's a mixed bag. Some of the positions that the state has, or you can generalize to public sector, some of them are paid less and some are paid more. And as a rule of thumb, the higher up you are in the hierarchy of education, experience, or compensation, the more likely you are to find yourself underpaid in the public sector. We see mixed results within our own ranks where we have trainees, whether they're land surveyors or engineers, and then people who run projects and have more years of experience. Given the shortness on time, unless you have specific questions about those mixed results, I'll simply refer you to the complete the report from our survey, which is on our website, MGEC, www.mgec.org. On our homepage, on the right side, it says Compensation Survey. There you've got, in full color, the 70-page report, and for those of us who prefer to be visual, 35 of the pages are roughly graphics showing you what the other 35 pages show. They're mixed together in words. I did want to just, as you talk about doing another survey, I wanted to suggest to you there's another problem that hasn't been discussed here today that you face and we face with the current employment laws, and that is, and perhaps Mr. Shepard can remind me of the exact citation. I didn't come preparing to give the citation, but the notion of it is that currently the state requires compensation to be done on a basis which is fair and consistent both internally and externally. And we have found with the engineering classes that the state has used the bias towards internal comparisons. In other words, we end up having our positions for the sake of gender purposes or supervisory responsibility purposes often compared and wages limited by the fact that we don't want to get out of skew the hay points associated with compensation. On the other hand, if the focus or the direction was given to MMB that you should focus on the private sector type of compensation and worry less about your internal requirements, then we would find that there would be some latitude or some authority in MMB to perhaps consider compensating our members more in line with what the private sector compensation is. But I know Deputy Commissioner Holmes testified maybe a month ago here that as long as there's a requirement for an internal and an external comparison, those two don't fall in line together. There's a tension between the two of them, and that's one of the problems with doing another study. You might get answers as to what compensation should be, but you won't have been given legislative authority to actually implement anything. So any bill that doesn't address that question simply creates for you yet another study without the ability to act and implement. I wanted to just take a moment to address some of the...
I'm sorry, we really are out of time.
Okay.
Representative Kahn, a quick question for Mr. Wheeler.
Well, actually it was on the previous one, I just wanted to point out that even though AFSCME was speaking, MAPE employees have long been known as the place where we trained information specialists, and then they went off and got very much higher paid jobs. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Wheeler. We need to move on, and want to give committee members one last opportunity for any questions of Representative Downey, and then give Representative Downey the final opportunity to speak to the bill. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to remind everybody how this all kind of comes together. The salaries that we have are actually bargained in a marketplace where the employer and the employee sit down and negotiate out a contract. The state sets a budget, and we set the maximum amount of money that can be spent by the government in the year. The legislature, after the governor has negotiated the contract, after the executive branch has negotiated the contract, the legislature actually approves that contract. So the taxpayer is represented by the budget that we pass, by the negotiation that is done by the executive branch, which is elected, and the contract that is ultimately approved by the legislature, which is also elected. So we have all kinds of checks built into that. We can get into a big discussion about inequity of pay in the private sector, but I think bottom line is I question the premise of even trying to make that comparison. But finally, we have a bill before us that spends $3.1 million for a study that largely repeats studies that have already been done and doesn't really begin to account for the complexity of comparisons necessary to even determine what the public sector is compared to the private sector. And it seems to me that this bill is just $3.1 million of spending that isn't necessary and really doesn't accomplish anything. We'd be better off saving the money and finding some other good purpose for it rather than pursuing this legislation. And so, Mr. Chair, I would urge a no vote on the bill, and I would request a roll call.
Roll call having been requested. Representative Downey, final word.
Well, just a couple of quick comments. I think the discussion around the Taxpayers Association study was helpful, and I hope people understand that was one more input that prompted me to even author the bill. The sample size was pretty substantial when you think about sample sizes that you can derive a reasonably statistically valid conclusion from. And so I think that's a nice pointer from for us. And as we've heard today, there are a lot of different inputs to the bargaining and contracting process right now, but there's a huge gaping hole that we're trying to fill with this particular study. And one thing that I observed as I looked at the Taxpayers Association study and went out and read the Rutgers study that Mr. Side referenced, the Rutgers study specifically does not include, it specifically excludes the position that the person is working in. And so I think the vast majority of the comparable studies that are done in the public sector are very geared towards education and experience, irrespective of what job that person is performing. And I think that is the value of this study. The gentleman from the engineers actually appears to have done a study that does a position-based analysis. I look forward to looking at that, and I'm hopeful, Mr. Chair, that we can pass this bill on. And with respect to the fiscal note, I've talked to the chair and the chair of Ways and Means, and we would resolve the fiscal impact of this particular bill at the Ways and Means level before it would pass on.
So, Mr. Representative Downey, do you want to renew your motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 2033 to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Motion to pass the bill as amended and referred to Ways and Means is before us. Roll call having been requested, the committee assistant will call the roll.
Chairman Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Benson.
Yes.
Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Anderson. Representative Banyan.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Yes.
Representative Gauthier.
No.
Representative Green. Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Leidiger.
Yes.
Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Lohmer.
Yes.
Representative McElpatrick.
Yes.
Representative Moline.
No.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Murray.
Yes.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Slawick.
No.
Representative Stinsrud.
Yes.
Representative Erdahl.
Sure.
Representative Winkler.
No.
Anderson.
Representative Anderson.
Yes.
This is sure constituted, yes.
Members, there being 12 yes and 8 no, the bill is passed and we'll move on to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, meeting adjourned.